pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, can you lead us in a roll call of the Planning Commission?
Commissioner Miller.
Here.
Commissioner Onan.
Here.
Commissioner Smith.
Here.
Vice Chair Fuller. Chair Maynard.
Here.
Thank you.
Looking at my speaker slips, it does not appear that we have any comments for the public forum. At this point, if there's anybody in the audience that would like to make a comment on anything that is not on our agenda today, this would be the time to do so. I'm not seeing any comments for the public forum. I'm getting confirmation from Madam Clerk. We will close the public forum, and then we'll move on to our administrative agenda. Madam Clerk, can you read that the first agenda item, A1, into the record?
Item A1 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission meeting of October 23rd, 2017. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. I have one question for other planning commissioners on the first meeting minutes today. So when we did the zoning ordinance workshops, we included both notations of the public comment as well as notations of the feedback from the Planning Commission. In the meeting minutes here, we did include, as we had before, the public comment feedback in the workshops, but we did not include the detail of the Planning Commissioner's comments. So one of the questions is, should we ask that those get added back in? I talked a little bit with staff, and there one of the comments was that we do have the videos, and the videos do capture this in detail. So is it important to also have that in the notes? And I wanted to ask the Planning Commissioners if they had any thoughts on that.
I had the same observation. I of course, wasn't here during the previous ordinance review, so mm-hmm. I don't have as much of a sense of what our custom has been. I know that we discussed minute taking at the mm-hmm. beginning of this year in terms of sort of having some additional information in the minutes in general. Mm-hmm.
I know we decided for like development projects, we wanted to keep those a little bit more brief in action minutes. But for workshops, we hadn't really discussed it for workshops, and that's a little bit of a different thing. In the past, when we did the zoning ordinance workshops, for example, we did include those details, but we've not done it for as long as I've been on the Planning Commission for development projects. So that's one of the sort of questions we're looking at here.
My initial reaction is that they should be included, and the reason is we weren't making a decision. We were hearing opinions, and then we were offering our own opinions, and then the information was going on to the City Council. And while it's true that each member of the City Council could watch the videotape, it seems to me it would make it much easier for them if they could read our comments in the minutes. That's my thought.
Commissioner Onan, did you have any thoughts?
I agree with the idea that normally, or maybe even going in the future, mm-hmm. that those comments should be included in the mm-hmm. minutes. I think, is there a question, should we ask staff to go back and mm-hmm. Recreate those for mm-hmm. these meetings? But mm-hmm. I would agree going forward, certainly we should. Mm-hmm. The other question I would leave to the Commission to figure out whether mm-hmm. that's important or not in this case.
Good. Chair and Commissioners, we can certainly go back and add more detail to the minutes, mm-hmm. and ultimately it's a question for you as a commission, how detailed you want your minutes to be. My own personal preference is that we let the video and the comments speak for themselves. I think there are pitfalls in trying to summarize your comments, and the Deputy City Attorney may have some views on that as well. So I think that the better practice is to just let, when you have a video recording, to allow that video and your comments to be what they are on that record. But again, it's a call for you, and I appreciate that there might be utility in allowing the council to read a summary rather than have to go back and watch the video.
I think that my understanding of how the zoning ordinance workshops have been put together is that it's kind of grouped by topic, and so viewpoints from commissioners as well as public members are really organized in that fashion rather than putting them in the minutes. It's really organized by topic so that we know what the public input was on any given topic so that we can shape a policy or ordinance that kind of follows that community input. So I would assume we're sort of moving in the same direction in this scenario. In gathering people's opinions, it's really what was the general opinion, and it may be specific to planning commissioners when it, you know, when we talk about cultivation or whatnot of marijuana. I think that the other, in expressing some, you know, thoughts about why would it make sense to have all planning commissioner comments in minutes is that you're just going to get into more of a debate of what whether or not the summary really captures your opinion. So that may add some staff time, that may add some planning commission time in reviewing those minutes and going back and forth on that. So, but certainly there's some utility in doing that. But it has to be weighed against what are the costs of bringing that forward.
If I might comment, I appreciate your comments from both of you, and that makes sense. Although I would just add this, that I wouldn't be suggesting that if we went back and included comments from the commission, it wouldn't be everything we said, but as I recall, when we went through item by item, at the end of each item or each category, we each would say we generally agree with that or we don't agree, and it was more of a summary that we gave at the end of each of those categories. And if we were to do anything, that's all I think that would be necessary.
Any other deliberation before we hear a motion?
Just a thought. I don't recall the video being referenced in the minutes. Maybe the video could be referenced as and included as part of the record, and then all of our comments are, you know, there for anybody to look at, and they're known that they're part of the minutes.
And perhaps it could state in the minutes that the commissioners did at the end of each category offer their comments on, or summary comments on each category.
Yeah, you could even put a reference to a time on the video so that people could, you know, like see, you know where to go and not have to wade through the whole thing if they wanted to.
Good idea.
Any additional deliberation? Okay. Would anybody like to make a motion?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. That we, I'd move that we ask the staff, excuse me, to amend the meeting minutes for the workshop on cannabis regulations to state, number one, that commissioners had comments on each of the categories, or I believe we each did at the end of each category or each topic, and that those comments are found at and include the location on the videotape for each category, as suggested by Commissioner Fuller.
I'll second that.
Okay. Any deliberation on that motion? Okay. We'll just go one by one for this one. That's right.
Yes.
Okay. No.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Staff will make the revisions as requested and bring those back at our next meeting.
So that was A1. Do we need to do that again for A2? Or will that be, I guess Madam Clerk should read in A2. Should I just do that part?
Item A2 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission's special meeting of October 30th, 2017.
And so this one, I believe, has the same dynamics as A1. This was another continuation of the cannabis ordinance workshop. And so, and minutes were taken in the same way, where comments from the public were noted, but comments from the Planning Commission were not. Do we want to have any deliberation or any changes on this before we take it to a motion? Would someone like to make a motion?
I'll move that we make the same changes to the, or revisions to the October, actually it's not revisions, it's that we add, make the same additions to the minutes for October 30 that we are making to the meeting minutes for the October 23 meeting.
Okay. I'll second.
Okay, well, we'll start on this side with Commissioner Smith.
Yes.
Vice Chair Fuller?
Yes.
Commissioner Onan?
No.
Commissioner Miller?
Yes.
And I also vote yes. Okay, I think that completes items A1 and A2, so we can move on to the entree for tonight, item B. Madam Clerk, can you read that in?
Item B1 is discussion item. It's the accessory dwelling unit ordinance workshop.
And I believe we'll start with a staff presentation today.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners, and welcome public to this public workshop, the first one on accessory dwelling units. There's been a couple rounds of revision to the government code, and that's why we're here tonight, is to go over what the state is telling us that we need to do, and then giving you some options as a first step towards developing our accessory dwelling unit ordinance. We have copies of the slide presentation in the foyer. There's also the government code included track changes government code. The reason that we included that version is because there's some recent changes that were not included in the staff report, and we wanted to make sure that everybody benefited from that. The state hasn't quite yet updated their official regulation page, but these are the final regulations that we are working from. And then similar to the last workshop that we had on cannabis, we have a workshop form, feedback form, so people can fill it out as you sit there. We're also going to have a break after we give a presentation so that we can go over to the easels in the other side of the room, and you guys can give us comments then. You can write them down, but you can also use these worksheets as a public tool to when you come and speak on the various items. And we will break for the Q&A on each item, so you'll have more than 3 minutes to talk about the various items. So with that, I'm going to hop into the presentation. The purpose, of course, is to give you information about the accessory dwelling unit requirements from the state law, and let you know where we have some latitude in state law. And that government code section is 65852.2. We will be looking tonight at primarily size of ADUs, and excuse me for the acronym. If you're okay with the acronym, I'm going to just say ADUs as opposed to accessory dwelling units. Okay. We're going to talk about the size, permit process, and some setback questions. And that's going to be the highlight of tonight, and then we'll come back with more. Again, you know, the state law, there's still some refinements that we have to understand what they mean. It hasn't been made completely clear. We're working on that, but we'll go through that later. So again, the agenda, the presentation, questions from you, we'll break and work on the posters, and then we'll receive public comment and then final commission feedback on our recommendations. So we're going to start the presentation with our general plan. So our housing element for a while now has had one sub-policy, HE 2.7, that is specific to the encouragement of accessory dwelling units, or it's called second units, or variations of those terms, but they pretty much mean the same thing. And the policy encourages ADUs on new and existing single-family residential lots. So the heart of that housing element sub-policy is consistent with the direction of the government code. It just provides that high-level policy guidance and doesn't break it down into details further. So the city's previous accessory dwelling unit regulations, or second units, did regulate the size standards. So on the screen in front of you is also in your staff report, it kind of lays out what the maximum accessory dwelling unit size is based on the lot size. And you can see we added in, Andy Newkirk did some GIS and threw in some percentages so you can get a sense for, you know, where, how much of the city is within these various lot sizes where there's restrictions. So if you estimate there's about 5,000 single family residences in the city, on the smaller lots are 26.5%, about 1,400 units. They're just not allowed. So no ADUs on the smaller lots. And then most of the remainder of the city is in that middle range, you know, 80-something percent, where it's the sizes are restricted to 400 square feet. So if you break down that category, the 60% is about 3,000 units, and then the 12% is around 600, and then 1% is about 50, and then 0.5 is about 20. These aren't perfect because we're not talking districts, we're talking houses, so units. So we're using accessor data, accessor parcel data to get this information. I wanted to point out, too, that our what we're calling city's previous accessory dwelling unit regulations were previous because they're what state law calls null and void now because they're not compliant. There were a number of restrictions in that those regulations, like the size restriction, in addition to what you see on the screen was 30% of the primary residential unit. And then a couple other, well, there were a lot of other restrictions, but I think some of the big ones were no ADUs within 300 feet of the property line of a proposed ADU. So there has to have a distance between them. And then also three lots separating existing from proposed. So there's a number of challenges for the development of ADUs in the city, and we haven't had any since we incorporated. Accessory dwelling units or second units. Right, we haven't issued any permits for them.
Since 2003?
Correct. I should point out the Water District was charging the single-family residential fee for second units, and it's really expensive. So it's not just the city regulations. The costs associated with a second meter were substantial. And now you can't even get a second meter. But again, those costs are substantial. And kind of focusing a little bit more on what our previous regulations were from a permit process standpoint, it's a land use permit or an LUP with expanded noticing requirements. So unlike many of our other land use permits where you just notice on your door, you have to do mailings and things like that for ADUs. And then I wanted to refer to ordinance number 03-07. It's on our it's on our website for accessory dwelling units for anybody who wants to take a look at it. It's probably on a few places on our website, but we tried to upload as many supporting documents as possible to our website. The setback part of our existing regulations in relation to the rear property line is driven by the base district. So in the R1 zoning district, for example, where many single-family residential units are, is a 25-foot rear setback. But there is an allowance to go down to 15 feet. You have to do a little bit of algebra to get there. It's on average. So, but 25 feet's the standard with that allowance to go down to 15. Okay, so shifting over to the state regulation that I previously had referenced, we've kind of broke those categories out into kind of bite-sized pieces. And if you looked at the regulations, it's not that easy to do that because there's a lot of references back and forth in the regulations. So we tried to get this in a format that's a little bit easier to understand. It's also in your staff report. broken out, but starting with the types of accessory dwelling units, there's, you know, some question about, you know, what is it? What is an ADU? It's simply put, it's an independent living facility. So it's a standalone, separate residence from the perspective of definition. I probably shouldn't have said standalone because it doesn't have to be standalone. But it does need to have a bathroom and a kitchen. And it would generally take three forms. So a detached, I think that speaks for itself. It's separate from the primary structure. And attached is, again, aligned with the primary unit. And then what we're calling a repurposed existing space might be a master bedroom that's converted to an accessory dwelling unit or a garage that's converted so it's within the primary residence. And then the size standards in state law, they look at the regs are different for detached versus attached. So detached, there's just a maximum size of 1,500 square feet, or sorry, 1,200 square feet. And then there is a minimum size for an efficiency units, and that's 150 square feet. For attached, it's 50% of the existing primary unit, so it's scaled now on the primary residence, but with a 1,200-foot square foot maximum. So where the city has some options here would kind of be within that 150 to 1,200 square foot box. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. From the perspective of allowed locations, ADUs are allowed where single family or multifamily residences are allowed. I'm going to show you a map in just a second of those so you can visually see what we're talking about in the city. The lot must contain an existing or proposed single family residence. And I want to emphasize or proposed. So now vacant lots, for example, that someone wants to develop can come in with an ADU and under state law. That's a relatively recent change from October. And we don't really have any options with those parameters of the regulations. So when you take a map and you're not looking at districts now, you're just looking at, you know, where do we have single family residences where you could possibly get accessory dwelling unit locations. Andy Newkirk made this map using GIS, so it's not, and it's not perfect because we don't necessarily know where every single residence is, but this is probably pretty close, and it's generally speaking in our R1 district and the DR district. So R1's kind of north of the freeway and the DR is south of the freeway. And we can spend more time with this map later if you want, but a lot of the city is included. So the access to the ADUs, no passageway shall be required. And the government code has some definitions, but it's pretty basic. And then an independent exterior access is required. That's kind of common sense. And the city doesn't have any options for that either. Regarding setbacks, so no setbacks shall be required for legally permitted existing garage that's converted to an accessory dwelling unit. That kind of makes sense. If an ADU is constructed above a new or existing garage, a setback of no more than 5 feet is required from the side and the rear lot lines. So we don't really have much option when it comes to setbacks for garages or garage conversions or ADUs above the garage. But for other ADUs, we can utilize other setback standards, so we have some discretion there. The permit review process, we have to review applications within 120 days of submittal. And I think really what's important here is that the application process has to be ministerial, meaning it can't have a hearing. There's no discretion. And so from a city option perspective, we can do a zoning clearance and just go straight to building, or we can do a land use permit. The way our land use permits are, all of them have hearing requirements. And so if we were to go look at LUPs in this case, we would have to clarify that there's no hearing allowed. The parking location. So the parking is a little bit confusing in the state law. So we spent a lot of time with this trying to really distill it down to something that we can work with here. So from an off-street parking perspective, it's allowed in the setbacks, and tandem configuration is also allowed unless the city makes certain findings. And in the city options in the far right column, we've kind of outlined what those findings are related to topography, fire, and life safety conditions. That those are the kinds of things we would be writing into the regulations for off-street parking. If existing parking is demolished or converted in conjunction with the construction of ADUs, and the lost parking must be replaced, the replacement parking may be configured as covered or uncovered in a tandem configuration or in a mechanical lift. So we could talk about this a lot if we want, but we still have some homework to do on what all of this exactly means. But right now, most of this doesn't apply because it only applies if you're within one half, or the requirement does not apply within 1/2 mile of public transit. And you'll see in a few minutes that most of our city is within 1/2 mile of public transit. But again, we still have some work to do on the parking location with the regs. So from a required parking perspective, it's at one space per unit or bedroom, whichever is less. However, no additional parking is required. So like that's the critical part, is no additional parking is required when the ADU is within 1/2 mile of public transit. Also, if it's located within architecturally and historically significant districts, which we don't have at this time. And then an ADU is part of the proposed or existing primary residence or an accessory structure. And then some other exceptions for parking permits, which we don't have, like the city of Santa Barbara downtown, there are some parking permits. So this would apply in those cases, but we don't have that here. And then when there's a car share vehicle located with one block of the ADU, we don't have that information, but we do have the transit. So I just wanted to point out that where we do have some discretion is we can reduce but not increase the parking standards. But that's going to be, we still have some work to do, like I said. So here's the map of a 1/2 mile parking buffers from the transit locations. So most of the city is included with the exception of the little neighborhood next to, let's see, Lake Los Carneros, north of Cayo Real. So you can see a lot of overlapping circles. So even if the bus route changed and there wasn't a stop, there's still a lot of overlapping circles that would be covered by different bus stops. Okay, so from a fee and charges perspective, ADUs are not considered new residential uses for the purpose of calculating your fees. And I don't think that affects us as much as it does some of the other special districts, and that the government code was in October clarified that it does apply to special districts. But new construction, new ADUs could incur fees depending on what the special district decides to do. We don't have any control over that because we don't have our own districts. Fire sprinklers, interestingly, are not required if they're not required for the primary residence. And that's just a blanket statement. We don't have any input on that. And there's some owner and rental restrictions. So the city, and that's where we do have some discretion, the city may require the applicant to be owner-occupant, and the city may require the owner occupancy of either the ADU or the primary unit and may require a deed restriction. And then the ADU may not be sold or conveyed separate from the primary unit. That's, you know, obvious. And then the city may prohibit the rental of an ADU. So no, we could prohibit short-term rentals less than 30 days. So if you look in the city options column, there is some ability for us to have owner occupancy and then eliminate the option for short-term rental. So tonight we're going to focus on the size and the permit process and the location on the lot related to that rear yard setback. Future issues might be fees, and we will talk a little bit about fees when we get to the recommendation, because when it comes to something like cost recovery for staff time, depending on some feedback we get from you and the public as far as how we should be permitting and processing ADUs with what kind of standards, there may be some ramifications when it comes to, if we were to go ministerial, for example, then there would be really very little money that would be recovered from planning time, wouldn't be accounted for. So we'd want to make sure to be thoughtful about that, that if there's going to be a lot of like design criteria kind of stuff that we're going to be looking at, then we might want to look at the LUP route without a hearing. But we can, let's get some input from you tonight and we'll come back and discuss fees. Parking, I've already mentioned we have some homework to do, so we can come back and discuss that later. And just emphasizing, there's a lot of other site constraints on each parcel, whether that be flood or habitat or setbacks. There's other site constraints that are still imposed for siting ADUs. There's junior ADU requirements. Those are relatively new. So we will, and those are in a different section of the government code. So we'll come back and talk about those. And then the subject of the owner and rental restriction. So again, the three questions: how should we regulate the size? How will they be permitted? And where should they be on the lot? In relation to that rear property line. So we're available for questions, and then a break, and then we'll go back and do the public comment and Planning Commission recommendations.
Okay, wonderful. So just kind of to recap this, so we'll do general questions from the Planning Commission now. We'll take the break, and you can comment on the three boards there. Planning Commissioners will walk around, so you can also talk to the Planning Commissioners as we walk through. And then we'll do each of the three recommendations one at a time. This will allow folks from the public, if you want to comment more than once, you can comment on each of the three recommendations separately and have the 3 minutes for each of the three recommendations. So I want to note that. And then when we're finished the three recommendations, we'll invite anybody who has comments that weren't included in those three recommendations to come up and share broader comments. So that'll be a sort of a fourth opportunity to speak. So just wanted to give that heads up to everybody as we go into this part. So let's go to Planning Commission questions.
No, sir. No, give me a second.
I understand that I guess I'd like to know more about the purpose of the ADU. I understand generally it's to provide more affordable housing. But beyond that, I guess I'm curious as to what kind of affordable housing is it meant to focus on? Was there any restriction considered in terms of numbers of occupants? I guess I'd just like to know more about what it is we're trying to do. What is it the state's trying to do, and therefore what are we trying to do?
So the state is trying to generate more housing opportunity in communities. So that's kind of the core driver behind the state law and the revisions, and more affordable housing. The minimum number of occupants is, you know, one, but more than one is allowed.
No maximum.
Is there a maximum, Andy?
No, and I think there's a lot of issues about kind of defining like a family and limiting number of people and in units. There will be certain space limitations based on the standards set forth. So if you have a, say, an 800 square foot unit, you know, there is a question of how many people could fit in that. But there's nothing explicit about like maximum number of individuals in a resident in an ADU.
And there's no income levels or goals to provide housing for people under certain levels of income.
Yeah, there's nothing spelled out, and then we have an inclusionary housing policy, but it does not apply to single units.
Okay, thank you.
You're right. So just to be clear, as I'm reading the code here, it says that we can adopt an ordinance, right? Otherwise, the state law will prevail, and we will be subject to the state law as it, they wrote it. But it says the ordinance shall do all of the following. So they have essentially laid out what we will have in our ordinance. Am I correct?
That's correct. I mean, if we don't adopt our own ordinance, then.
But even if we adopt our own ordinance, they're telling us the ordinance shall do the following.
Yes.
They're not saying may do the following or we suggest you have the following in the ordinance. They're saying the ordinance shall do the following, which is telling you you will do this or you will not do anything. You know, except where they provided us the leeway, such as in setback and size of units, like that. There's a few places as I was reading it also, and I was at least thankful to see that they did include architectural review in the list of things that we could include. And that's correct. Is that
we can't require that they go to the design review board, for example. But we can have some design standards that could be handled by a planner at the counter, for example. So if that's something that, you know, we're looking at, then we'd want there to be some really basic standards that a planner could
probably use. At least, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did want to mention that the mandate is in place, which is why we're here. We were working on the regulations as part of the new zoning ordinance, and those were a little different than what we're talking about now. So again, this is why we're here, taking this out of order mm-hmm. from the new zoning ordinance.
One of the things I was really kind of startled to see the great coverage we have by transit in the Goleta Valley. And as that translates, I'm reading or understand that if somebody decides to convert their garage, we therefore cannot require them to add any additional parking because they're within a certain distance of the transit. Is that correct?
We think so.
Yeah, that's the way that seems mm-hmm. the law is written. So, all right, thank you.
I do have a question. Commissioner Miller and I were talking about the maximum, and I wanted, and it does appear in this thing that it states there is a 12,000 square foot maximum in all cases. 1,200 square foot. Excuse me. Did I misspeak there?
We're not in Montecito.
Okay. Sorry. But I wondered, why is that number significant in a limit in this legislation? I know that our past standard was actually more restrictive than that. Any rationale? Does anybody understand that?
I don't know. Unless I'm sure they use some standard, some numeric. They probably had, you know, some kind of. Well, I'm not going to go into what their math might be.
Yeah,
but there probably is some method to their madness.
You know, if you had it based on lot size and it increases to some certain amount, it makes sense that a less than a half acre or a half acre square lot, that an acre lot could accommodate more. That differential that nothing exists in that size zone seems restrictive, but as it says, it's called out specifically. maybe this isn't the time, but I'd like to understand, is there an option for a property owner to somehow pursue more than that, other than probably adding on to their existing dwelling and then being able to go to maximum size?
Is your question related to that, how hard of a cap that is at 1,200
square
feet? Yeah,
this looks like it's a hard cap at 1,200. Yeah. There's no exception going over that.
I think that, you know, 1,200, you know, they don't want to create a new unit. So these are theoretically subordinate to the primary dwelling unit. So they're, that's why I think there's some math that they used and some averages that they used across the state as far as the size of typical primary single-family residence. I don't know what their math is, but
2,400 square feet.
There you go.
For a single-family.
Yeah.
Resident. All right. Any other questions, Commissioner? Okay.
Oh yes. Just following up on Commissioner Fuller's question. I didn't know if at a future workshop if design was going to be a consideration or if that's something sort of staff was going to take under consideration and maybe bring that back another time. Or
I think we'll be bringing that back to you. We had previously discussed as part of the new zoning ordinance some design, so we wanted to get through these items and then come back with kind of a more robust package with something for you to look at and then address some of those outstanding issues like design.
This may be more of a comment than a question, but I note that this, in terms of the size of the ADU, the state uses the size of the primary residence as the determination for how big the ADU can be. And I noticed that our regulations have used the lot size. And as I've tried to think about that, it seems like it should almost be some sort of combination of the two, but I don't know how you do that. It probably gets more complex, but just a thought I had as I was reading this before I came tonight and then hearing the presentation.
I'd be curious if you could give us the pros and cons of lot size versus unit size or what some of the thinking, like why we decided to go with lot size originally.
Sure. And I wanted to remind everyone too that this is a workshop, so Peter and Andy can chime in and not, you know, not feel like we're the formalities exist, but you know, the lot size when you restrict it, well, let me start with the if you use your unit size, your primary unit. If you're scaling it off of your primary unit, it's always going to look, the ADU is going to always look smaller, right? It's always going to look secondary to it. If you're scaling it off of your lot size, theoretically, you could have a smallish house and have a little bit bigger or equal to second unit. But that would, you would have a, you know, potentially a large lot. But there could be situations where that would happen. In the city, or could potentially happen if that was the desire of a property owner.
Maybe I can just add to that. Ann and I talked about this in advance, and of course, there are a number of ways to approach this, but lot size is simple. It's straightforward. We know what the lot size is, and that's the way our pre-existing ordinance was set up based on lot size. That's also the way some other jurisdictions have approached it. That isn't to say that we couldn't come up with some kind of a combination, as Commissioner Miller is suggesting.
And one other question on that one, is there any, is one of those two methods more consistent with the state ADU guidelines?
I'm not sure. I mean, the state ADU guidelines give us fair flexibility. Mm-hmm. The only restriction that's suggested based on resident size is for attached ADUs, where the suggestion is that they be limited to 50% of the size of the primary dwelling, but there is no guidance on detached ADUs.
Okay. Thank you. I jumped in, but did you have any other questions? Okay. Did you have any other questions?
Just as a comment on that, I'm wondering if getting to that question about the lot size versus primary residence size, we have rules regarding lot coverage. Is that correct?
Right. There's a lot of standards on lot coverage, and your front, rear, and side yard setbacks. So your box is getting pretty constrained.
Right. So I was just thinking that our lot coverage regulations might address some of the concerns about sort of the use of the space within the lot.
From a lot size perspective.
Yeah. Are we worried about consistency at all with our lot coverage guidelines and the minimum size we have to allow?
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I think there's enough space. I mean, the minimum size is efficiency unit or 150 feet. Okay. We did, you know, look at some, you know, we kind of charted out some lots and if you scale it, if you use something scalable, like the state law requires for the attached, you know, it works within the lot ratio restriction.
I had a couple of questions. So we briefly looked at some multifamily. Can you talk a little bit about, so there's one guideline I saw, so allowed locations. So they're allowed where single family or multifamily residents are allowed, but the lot must contain an existing or proposed single family residence. So am I reading that correctly, that if it's a multifamily residences are allowed, but there's only a multifamily residence and not a single family residence, can you do an ADU?
I think the way we read that is no.
Okay.
But there are areas even within the city that are multifamily districts that do have single family.
Yeah.
And you know, okay. You got to squint to look at the map to find them, but they do exist. So
okay.
they are out there. So those would still qualify even though they weren't in a predominantly single-family zoning district, they would still qualify under that kind of two-part test.
Great. Follow-up
and
question.
Chair, if you don't mind, before we go too far, because I misspoke.
Okay.
The R1 has no lot coverage. DR does. So I wanted to make sure that was clear.
Okay.
All right.
How does this work with homeowner associations? Do they have to allow ADUs if it's a single-family residence? But it's a neighborhood that's covered by a homeowners association?
We asked this question, and I don't think we really came to a conclusion. Half the planners said yes, and half the planners said no. So we still have some work to do to tease this part out.
I would say that I happen to be president of a homeowners association, and having spent a fair amount of time reading CC and R's, I doubt very much that the city could override a HOA's restriction on ADUs to allow an individual homeowner to erect a ADU in violation or that's contradictory to the CC and R's. That's my thought.
Sounds familiar.
But this is state law.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, state law supersedes and overrides.
Well, state law
about everything.
It's state law until we pass our own regulation.
Well, that's true, but yeah.
But I don't know that if there's something in the state law you think that might compel an HOA to permit an HDU.
If you wouldn't mind, if maybe we set that question aside. Because I think we can get to the bottom of that because we, you know, there are other jurisdictions that have dealt with this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we just need to look a little bit more thoroughly at that and get back to you on that question.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I have two other ones. You had talked about garages, so there's no option. So for setbacks, there's no options for garage conversions or above garage conversions. I assume that's also for bedroom conversions. You had mentioned that was an option before. I assume the guidelines are the same for garage and bedroom because it's still within the same unit?
Yes.
Okay. And then, okay, so parking. So we have a very small amount of area where we can add we can have the parking regulations or where they apply because of the bus lines. But let's talk about that one little neighborhood where it's not covered by the bus lines. So if a garage was So it says off-street parking is allowed in setbacks and tandem configuration unless the city makes findings. And one of the findings we can make is tandem parking
or parking and setbacks is not permitted anywhere else in the jurisdiction, that's true for the city of Goleta, that that's not allowed, tandem parking and setback parking isn't allowed in Goleta? Question mark?
Yeah, I mean, the required parking is not allowed in setback, in the front setback.
Yeah. And also, and we don't allow tandem parking or, as well. Is that correct or no? That might have been in the zoning ordinance. I don't know if it's here.
You can. Okay. It just doesn't count.
Right? It just doesn't count. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So then one question I've got is, if existing parking is demolished or converted, and then it allows, specifically says that tandem is one of the configurations that's possible there, but if we make the finding that tandem's not allowed in Goleta, which we have to verify if that's true, then is that one of the ones we have to allow?
We're not exactly sure.
Okay.
That's one of the things we have to research a little bit more because,
I'm happy to add it to the research list. I don't need an answer tonight.
Okay,
that was all the questions that I have before we go to public comment. So let's actually go back for quickly. Okay, so we did questions from Planning Commission. Any other Planning Commission questions at the stage? Not seeing any. We're going to take a quick break. You had recommended 15 minutes, is that correct? So we are at 4:51, so we will do it at 7:05. We will come back, and then what we'll do once you all come back is we'll take comments for each of the three recommendations, and then at the end we'll take general comments for anything not on one of the three recommendations. So you have four chances to speak after our 15-minute break that will begin now and go until, we'll say, 7 after 7.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. A tinkling piano apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant, a fairground's painted swings, these foolish things.
Okay, so the first recommendation set is related to accessory dwelling unit size. And what staff is recommending that you consider is regulating attached and detached units consistently. And I think we kind of explained in the staff report that we thought that this approach would be more straightforward, that there isn't really that much of a difference with the attached or detached from a visual perspective. And that the important thing is that subordinate in character from a size perspective, not overshadowing the size of the primary residential dwelling unit. And let's see, and if so, we were recommending that there be a range of the size that scaled off of the house again, so shifting from the lot size and over to the primary dwelling unit size, so that it's that scaled. And if you were to do that, we give an example that's based on the state law default of 50% of the primary dwelling unit. That's what's suggested in state law, that's what is required in state law if we don't have our own ordinance. So it doesn't have to be 50%. It could be less. It could be 40%, 30%, or whatever it might be. If it was 50%, we were looking at the ranges of unit sizes in the city, just so you can kind of get an idea of what percent of our city single-family residences could potentially have a kind of smaller or larger accessory dwelling unit. And, of course, this is not taking all the other site constraints into factors like the setbacks and the other things and the lot size. All of those things would cut down on the box size of the parcel. So you can see about, you know, half the city would have a range of 800 to 1,200 square feet. So we'd be honoring that cap of 1,200 and then the minimum of 150 and scaling it from there. So a lot of the city would be in, you know, that 600 to 1,200 square foot range if we were to scale it off of the primary dwelling unit size. So that's really the essence of our recommendation. Again, we're here to help you understand other scenarios. If that's what you desire, you can give us more direction to go do more homework if that's your desire. But this was our starting point of recommendation that we thought would work in the city.
Are there any clarifying questions from the Planning Commission before we take public comment on recommendation set one? Not seeing any. So what we're going to do with this is a little bit different than a normal public comment. So everybody has to have submitted at least one speaker slip, but you only have to do one. You don't have to do a speaker slip for each of the items. And we're going to go ahead and just let folks line up for questions rather than reading it through the speaker slip, because I want to find out who has comments specifically on recommendation set number one. And if you have comments on any other item, we'll invite you up a little bit later in the workshop. So any feedback on size, come on up. And please say your name when you get to the podium.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, thank you. Thank you for this workshop. It's always very helpful to have this format, I think, and I think the public probably appreciates it too. My only comment, I don't have specific comments on this. I just, having done this at the county and having been on the city's design review board for a decade where we looked at single family homes and did a lot of site visits in the neighborhoods, my only consideration for you is that you look at sort of the character of the neighborhoods and streetscapes to understand sort of what's out there and understand that bigger, whatever bigger may mean to you, isn't necessarily better. Putting an attached in the backyard, there's going to be a lot of constraints because there's a lot of stuff on people's lots. I mean, there's expansions, there's already additions, there's just a lot of limitations in people's backyards. And I think in my consideration, and what I think you heard tonight from Ms. Wells, is that this is really about affordability. So the bigger the unit, however you describe bigger, the more rent you're going to get for that. And I liken it to a home in my neighborhood that's a four-bedroom home. It's fairly small. They get $1,000 a bedroom. This home is, what, 1,200 square feet? I don't know. It's not very big. So something that's small is really, again, it's how you look at small. But I urge you to consider that the maximum may not necessarily be the best for our neighborhoods. And it all depends. It depends upon lot size. As you go west, the lots are smaller. As you go north, the lots are bigger. As you go east, the lots are 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 square feet. So it sort of depends. In the county, what the county did, they went 8% of the lot size. It was pretty easy. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of hybrid ways to do. I don't have any specific, but I just want you to consider that maybe bigger isn't necessarily. There's other factors that you have to consider. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And remember to say your name when you come to the podium.
So I'm Paul Poirier. I'm here representing the American Institute of Architects, Santa Barbara mm-hmm. chapter. Real quick, I'd just like to say that we'd love to work with planning to help you guys craft a really good ADU ordinance, because we think that this is an opportunity for the city of Goleta, the city of Santa Barbara, the county of Santa Barbara, to really start providing not just affordable housing, but workforce housing for those people that I employ as an architect and many other businesses in the area. are looking to attract people to come here, and it's really hard to get people to be able to afford a place to live. When I first moved to town, I lived in Goleta at numerous different houses, renting a room. We didn't pay that much money. I wasn't making that much money as a junior draftsman, but I lived in Goleta out off a foothill near DP, and then I lived up in a nice canyon, upgraded to a nicer four-bedroom house up in Vereda del Ciervo, and then finally moved downtown, lived in the ghetto in Santa Barbara on Gota Street, again renting a house with my fiancé at the time with another couple, so two couples living in one house. I'd like to say that all of those things were in legal houses, legal, you know, rental situations, but if we had been able to have our own kitchen and own bathroom instead of sharing those things, we really wouldn't have generated any additional parking, any additional water use, any other additional neighborhood impacts. We would have maybe had a little bit more living space in all of those situations. So that's really how young people have to get started in town here. They're not going to roll into town with a college degree and buy a house here. That's pretty obvious. At any rate, I wanted to bring some data in. Someone asked how they came up with 1,200. I'm sure it's based on the average home size, national home size, which is 2,400 square feet right now. And they just said, accessory dwelling unit, probably 50%. So I brought some NAHB, National American Home Builder stuff, for their latest average unit sizes for you to consider. Again, they have a spectrum, large, medium, and small. So taking small, the average studio, I think, was 415 square feet to 600 square feet. A one bedroom is 882 square feet. A small two bedroom is between 1,011 square feet and 1,115 square feet. And that's for apartment type things. You know, the one bedroom has a kitchen, a dining room, a bedroom, a bathroom, a little laundry thing. So, you know, 882 square feet is what the same exact occupancy could be, a couple, could be one person living in a one bedroom, as you would have in a 200 square foot space. It's just really kind of amounting to the quality of life of the people living there. So I think that there's a need for housing, sure, for the low income, but also for the working income people too. Sorry, my time is up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Poirier.
Good evening. My name is James Cariaco. I'm a lifelong resident of Goleta and Santa Barbara. You know, what we're talking about tonight is the result of the state identifying a need for more affordable housing in California. And they weren't necessarily looking at communities like Goleta when they were crafting this. They were looking at other communities, different types of lots, different types of formulas and whatnot. And I think what's important for us here tonight is to recognize that, you know, 1,200 square feet is the ceiling, but that doesn't mean we have to treat it like it's the floor. And what I mean by that is we don't want to, in our interest in being reasonable and trying to be accommodating to the homeowner, inadvertently sort of McMansionize our lots by putting large accessory dwelling units next to semi-large houses, and then suddenly they're going almost lot line to lot line. That's not going to be good for the character of our neighborhoods. The next thing I would just say is that we don't have to allow up to 1,200 square feet, and there's an incentive to not do that. And RENA is coming back in 2023. You know, we're coming up on our 8 years here pretty soon, where we're going to need to look again at our housing allocation. And SB CAG is going to determine what our Goleta housing allocation is going to be. And if you can make sure when you're looking at your sizes of the single family residences and coming up with what your maximum size is, there's an opportunity for you to have some of these houses meet the RENA formula for low and very low income housing. There's a way to do this where we can meet our affordable housing need, provide the smaller units that people need, and perhaps satisfy some of the state mandates that are going to impact the future character of our community. So that's all I'll say there.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments on recommendation set number one? Not seeing any additional comments at this point. I'll take it for Planning Commission comments. Who'd like to start us off? Commissioner Onan?
Yeah, I'll throw something on the table for us to discuss. So when we're looking at, I think the first question of attached and detached, try to regulate them consistently, mm-hmm. Would be a good first step, in my opinion. When we look at how do we allocate versus size of residence versus lot size, and just one thing that jumps out at me is that if we do it by size of residence, 48.8% of our residents would be in the qualifying zone of 800 to 1,200 square foot as the maximum. In other words, bumping up against the maximum. If we use a methodology of lot size, that's 13.5%, the bottom three categories, that then become eligible to meet the maximum capacity of 1,200 square foot. And I think the other discussion in that is that larger lot sizes have better opportunity to deal with the impacts. You know, you're getting to a three-bedroom. Is that conceivable? Certainly a two-bedroom. Parking impacts and stuff like that could seem logically to be better accommodated in those lot bases rather than the fact that, I mean, it's conceivable we could have a 3,200-square-foot house on under 10,000 square foot lot. Mm-hmm. Are we at 30% recommended lot coverage? We're not in residential, are we? No lot coverage requirement. Coverage. Yes, we established that. So anyway, that would be the concern that jumps out to me in the differential of how we mm-hmm. Allocated it. It was interesting to hear an 8%. I mean, our table kind of reflects 10%. Mm-hmm. If you look at where it reflects as far as lot size and allowable is a 10% reflection, I think those are reasonable assumptions that may aid to our regulation, appropriate size appropriate regulation.
Mm-hmm. It looks like we've got Commissioner Smith.
Sure. I'm wondering if we might consider some kind of hybrid approach that could get to the concerns about the lot size relative to the size of the primary residence, whether that's through the ADU ordinance. I'm not sure if that would have to be addressed as a lot coverage question, but if there might be a hybrid approach, because it seems to me you could have a small house on a large lot or a big, a large mm-hmm. house on a small lot, and so. I'm wondering if there might be a way for us to get to that in a way that's manageable. My overall impression is that the maximum allowed under state law for our community is just simply too big. I feel like for the average person, when we think about in our minds just what is an accessory dwelling unit, my just gut instinct is that we don't think of something that's as big as, some homes or two-bedroom apartments. 1,200 square feet is pretty significant. So I would be in favor of reducing that down. Those are just some of my initial thoughts.
I think you have Vice Chair Fuller, and then I can go this
way. Yeah, I'm reserved to make further comments, but... with regards to the lot size, I think that there's going to be natural constraints on what size people can put on them based on setbacks and existing structures. You know, if they've already got a 3,200 square foot house on a 7,000 square foot lot, they probably could maybe get, convert part of the interior into a unit. And that's something else to consider is that, these ADUs aren't necessarily new additions to the structure. They might be, a 2,400 square foot house that somebody mm-hmm. turns into essentially a duplex, right? Where they're mm-hmm. half of it is 1,200 and half of it's 1,200 without actually adding any more square footage. So mm-hmm. just some thoughts.
Commissioner Miller?
Yeah, and it's that last point that I've been thinking about when we talk about treating attached and detached the same. There's a couple sub-issues there that I think we have to consider. One is where it's an existing residence, that they're simply dividing it up to have an ADU. I guess I would consider treating that differently than building a new unit. And then we have also garages. It's permitted mm-hmm. at least under the state statute, if we did the same, convert garages. And if you convert an existing garage, then you're not changing the look of the, essentially not changing the look of the buildings on the lot and how that looks in terms of being too big. And I'll follow up on a comment from Commissioner Smith. I too tend to think 1,200 is too large. I think a lot of two bedroom, two bath apartments are in the area of 1,000 square feet, can be. At least I know of one that's quite comfortable that has 1,028 square feet, two bedroom, two baths. So I tend to think 1,200 is too much, particularly if it takes us out of not being, you know, if it's easier to satisfy the RENA targets, as the speaker mentioned. He didn't mention a number, but assuming that's less than 1,200, I guess I would like a number that would help us meet the target.
I have a couple of questions, so maybe I'll jump in. What is the size of an average garage? Any guesses on that?
Single or double?
400 square feet for a single, and for a double, 800 then? No. Double is 400 square feet. Okay.
400 to 440.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's helpful to get a sense of. So can you talk about the RENA targets and if having smaller sizes would help us with RENA or not?
I don't have the RENA information for you tonight, okay. But if you want us, if that's a factor that you want us to look into and track, because that's not a, that's going to be a moving target. Okay. But I think we can definitely take that into consideration as we start drafting up something for the next meeting.
I'd like to learn more about that in the future, sure. and happy to have that as homework. There seems to be one of the ideas on the table, and I want to clarify if we can do it, is so maybe saying what the maximum might be 10% of the lot size or 50% of the existing primary residence, whichever is smaller? Like, is that a thing that you could do? And I'm not saying we'll stick with 50 and 10, but just I want to go back to this, is the hybrid, does that work? So could you say it can be no more than 10% of lot coverage or 50% of the primary dwelling unit, or which, like, you'd have to go by whichever is the smaller number? Is that a thing that we could do?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Could I just have some discussion on that one? So,
sure.
We still end up with the exposure there of, of a larger house, a 2,000 square foot house on a relatively small lot. What would that, if we were down to a 7,000 square foot, or just say for a relative basis. And so then they get to put more into that smaller lot. And really,
wouldn't they still be capped at the 10% of the lot?
Well,
I think that's a proposal with a hybrid.
If you're going to have a hybrid, you must have an either-or type of conclusion. You're going to let them do whatever is greater, or...
No, I'm saying whichever's smaller.
Whichever's smaller.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm not proposing at this point whether I think 10 and 50 are the right numbers. I just wanted to see if we could do a hybrid as make sure that methodology works, and then we can debate about whether 10 and 50 are the right numbers or not.
Yeah, I think kind of the discussion is, you know, where will it occur and where will it make the most impact? Obviously, the larger size in the smaller lot communities will have more impact because they're closer together, less curb parking, all the things that go into those kind of communities. And they're yet, we're doing it, we're not considered of lot size. So it's a little bit of a challenge either way, but give us most ability to protect those particular properties from overdevelopment.
I'm going to go back to Vice Chair Fuller.
Okay. So I'm being persuaded in your direction. 10% of a 6,000 square foot lot would be 600 square feet. You know, if it's got a 1,000 square foot house on it, it'd be a 500 square foot unit. You know, if it's a 2,400 square foot house on a 6,000 square foot lot, then it would be a 600 square foot unit. So, you know, this seems like a relatively fair way, in my opinion, to kind of parse this out. And You know, again, I think that setbacks, you know, will also help if we decide to keep the existing setback requirements, you know, will help keep it, you know, more compatible with the neighbors, you know, not overbearing on them.
But doesn't it, when we talk about square footage size, it probably depends on whether it's one story or two story. And it seems like that should be considered.
But, you know, if it's a 6,000-square-foot lot, it's 600. It's a smaller of the two. So if it's a 6,000-square-foot lot, you know, in a 2,000-square-foot house, it's not a 1,000-square-foot addition. It's a 600-square-foot addition.
Can we go back to this question about attached versus detached and whether we're doing two different numbers there? Because I think that actually helps me understand this argument, too, because I think we've heard some different arguments about whether we should have different numbers for attached versus detached, and I'd love to hear more on that from commission.
Okay, so actually, almost, we should almost have a third category, which is, you know, existing structure.
Yeah.
You know, because it doesn't necessarily mean that it's in the garage. You know, somebody could, you know, take their garage and add, you know, a couple more extra rooms to it, or, you know, just take, you know, the extra wing on the side where their kids used to be and turn that into, you know, an ADU unit without really changing anything or square footage. But here we are, we're setting up a certain size standard on it, you know, when in fact they're not changing any of the total square footage or lot coverage or, you know, any other alterations to the existing structure.
Yeah, I'd say, I think it was Commissioner Miller who had originally, or sorry, Commissioner, yes, Miller, who had originally brought up the comment that, like, if it's an existing structure and you're just dividing the existing structure, maybe we're more open to size. And I thought that was a good point. So that leans me towards keeping different for existing versus new.
And one other point before I forget, go back to the question of the building size. I guess the term, I don't know why the term footprint wouldn't be used. It seems to me that's more meaningful than the total square footage of the house, but I don't, the state statute just refers to square footage, right? Doesn't talk about footprint, for example. It just seems to me that a 2,000 square foot house in two stories is about the same as a 1,000 square foot house in footprint, so. Of course, you got bulk comes in, you know, one's higher.
Right. And then my only other thought in terms of thinking about whether the size, if something's changing within the existing unit, is that we are limited in terms of parking considerations. If the change, even if there's no change in the overall square footage, if a change, you know, leads to a situation where there's, you know, potentially two families living within one structure, we're limited, I guess, in terms of thinking about impacts of things like parking. So that's the only other factor in the back of my mind when thinking about even when there's a change within the existing structure, that there's still potential for other impacts.
But, you know, even today, three families can inhabit a single-family house with three bedrooms. So, you know, we're just limited on our ability to address it. And we can see where it's already a problem, even with the way things are. So,
I was struck tonight by the comment that we've had a scheme that was adopted in 2003 and no one has built a unit. So I don't know whether we're talking tonight about something that's not going to happen, but maybe we should be thinking about or have some analysis of why hasn't it happened. Is it because people just ignore the permitting process, or is there some part of our regulation that is holding people back from doing this? And if we do want to encourage it, what is it we need to overcome that has prevented anyone from building an ADU or adding an ADU since 2003?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because I think it also says that, you know, we don't have to worry about a proliferation of this. More than likely, what we're concerned is how do we balance it in those individual circumstances, you know, so that it's still compatible right. within that neighborhood where it is, and what happens with those immediate impacts rather than worrying about there being a large number of them making a change. A question that popped up during our discussion was, do we anticipate or should we be also be structuring this to allow those conversions that have occurred without permitting to come in? Because I think that would be a benefit of this as well. In other words, we know they exist.
Like an amnesty?
Well, because the cost structure may be different, the process will be different, but shouldn't we also consider that is a benefit of complying with this? Because those that would come up to standard, mm-hmm. it's better housing than perhaps it is in the existing state it is. It'd be safer, mm-hmm. more conducive, better amenities that mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily make it less expensive, but it certainly makes it better mm-hmm. quality housing.
One thing I would comment on, because I was following some of the other meetings that have happened for City of Santa Barbara and the county, and one of the comments that I'd heard made was the price of the permitting process really can change how many people come in. And so just to go back to your comment of, you know, how many ADUs might be proposed. My understanding now, and I know we're not talking about fees tonight, but my understanding is the City of Goleta current rates are fairly much higher than the City of Santa Barbara's right now. And I believe when the City of Santa Barbara, when they changed their rate structure, they ended up with a lot more people applying. So I don't know how that's going to change for us, but as we look at some of these barriers and restrictions, it may affect how many people apply.
I would agree it will affect, because, I mean, one of the big, you know, for us was the cost of separate water meter, electric meter. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if we had sewer hookup required. Yeah. It's a sewer district requirement. So we're going to have some of those costs be cut down, mm-hmm. Which would be helpful. And maybe that, mm-hmm. again, that was the reason why no one went with, or I shouldn't say no one, but there were a lot of conversions of garages because they didn't want to comply with those requirements, or, of course, where we were bumping into each other between distances between, because we had that restriction in our ordinance for a long time. I think it would be interesting. I think it would be beneficial if we could mm-hmm. make more of those existing units legitimate. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I want to get us back to the size. So recommendation set one, size. We've had some discussion back and forth about different regulations for whether it's existing or new, whether it's attached or detached. I've heard a number of things tonight. Does anybody want to take a stab at maybe we're not going to vote on anything tonight, but just a little bit of sort of how you think this conversation's maybe evolved so we can sort of test the agreement across the board?
If I could, Chair, individually, mm-hmm. if we have our comments and see clarity and a direction, I think we should all go on record as giving that information.
That sounds great. Would you like to start?
Oh. okay. So as far as I wasn't prepared exactly for that turnaround, but I'm leaning towards the lot size as being more conducive and giving us the ability to, for my final one, seeing that 48% of dwelling units, and you know what, doggone it, I never did really clearly answer my question. How many dwelling units, did you say 5,000 was the number of dwelling units we were using as the number of single family dwelling units in the city? 5,000.
Approximately 5,300.
Okay, thank you. But the final of saying that 13.5% of those units would be eligible to go to the max of 1,200 versus in square footage, mm-hmm. a basis of square footage, we'd have 48% of them being possibly being eligible to go to the 1,200. So it also seems it just allows for the ability to deal with impacts on the lots associated mm-hmm. with it.
And are you wanting to consistent of between attached and detached and new and old?
Thank you. Maybe not. I mean, that because if you're using this number, doesn't that kind of create a confusion for within an existing structure? Mm-hmm. So I might say that existing has a different look at it mm-hmm. within the existing structures.
Okay, Commissioner Miller.
I think I've already given my comments, but let me see if I can summarize what I've said. I think a hybrid is what we should have, and I think that, Madam Chair, you suggested using a square foot a restriction on the house and on the lot size, and having a whichever one is smaller. I don't know what those numbers are exactly, but mm-hmm. but that method I think would work well without causing too much complication. And I just tend to think if we were just only going on the numbers up there, the number I would change, instead of 800 to 1,200, I would say 800 to 1,000. And then I think that as to the first bullet point, attached and detached, I do think that existing structures have to be treated differently and maybe somewhat more liberally than adding a structure.
Commissioner Smith.
I would also favor some kind of hybrid approach. I think that could get address these concerns about impacts relative to the lot and then also the concept. And I think it's consistent, again, with what the average person thinks of as an accessory dwelling unit, that it is something sort of secondary and less than where it's detached or where it's an addition as something smaller than the primary residence. I'd be interested in more information about the attached detached. I'm a little bit concerned that some of the impacts with existing versus something new, I'm concerned about that some of the impacts, even if it was within the existing, some of the impact would still be similar. So that's a concern. Did I miss anything? And I think in terms of just overall, regardless of what method we go with, that I really just think that our range, we need a smaller range. I just think for our community, 1,200 feet is just too big.
Vice Chair Fuller?
Well, I'll be one of the few people to speak in favor of larger units. Not every place is going to be able to have one. So, it'll allow a greater variety of, housing options. Although larger units are more expensive, they don't necessarily go up as dramatically as, might think. A four-bedroom house is a four-bedroom house to a lot of renters, and whether it's 1,200 square feet or 1,800 square feet, they may only pay for another 10% more for the extra square footage. So I think having allowing variety is not a bad thing. We're going to have plenty of smaller units just based on the constraints that we put on these. So I would second the chair's proposal of 10% of the lot size or 50% of the living space, whichever is less, for any unit that requires a new construction, an addition to the existing structure mm-hmm. or a separate dwelling unit. For existing dwellings, I think we should, go with the state's when there's no new additions of square footage or footprint, mm-hmm. Of 50% up to 1,200 square feet. So that's my thinking.
All right. So what I'll say, a couple things. So let me talk about size first. So I really appreciated the public comment where they noted what some of these sizes mean. And one of the comments was that the average one-bedroom apartment is somewhere around 880 square feet. And I also think about these units as they don't just have a bedroom, they have a kitchen, they have a restroom. There's a lot of things that are required in here that take square footage. I would be open to limiting to 1,000 square feet. I wouldn't want to go much lower than 1,000 as the maximum, but I could be convinced from reducing from 1,200 to 1,000. I would recommend that for existing buildings where there's no new construction, there might be a renovation, but no added footprint expanding beyond the existing walls of the building, I would say a 50% size limit, 50% of the existing property makes a lot of sense to me. For new construction, I do favor the hybrid approach, no more than 10% of the lot size and no more than 50% of the size of the existing structure or the primary residence, with whichever one is smaller winning out. So that's my thoughts on that. I will quickly allow, I know I kind of threw that at everyone to do your summaries. So if anybody did feel like you thought of something while we were hearing from other commissioners, go for it.
I just wanted to clarify, I don't support the idea of making it smaller than 1,200 square foot. I was actually looking at the law and was disturbed that it was limited at 1,200 square foot. But recognizing what it says is that it can't exceed that. But otherwise, I don't. I think, again, with a lot size regulation or even with a hybrid where we are looking at lot size, that bigger unit will have to be on a relatively large lot. So why not have that additional space?
It would be 12,000 square feet. You'd have to have at least a 12,000 square foot lot, you know, to build a 1,200 square foot unit.
Any comments you haven't made? Yeah.
Another comment for me on the size. Part of my reason for going for 1,000 and not 1,200 is that the purpose for the statute is to provide more housing, more workforce housing, more affordable housing. And so I think when you start getting over 1,000, you're going to start being in conflict with that goal. So that I just have a sense that going over 1,000 is going to make the units too expensive for beginning workforce and other people in lower income categories.
Well, I don't think we need to decide this tonight. So any other comments on this? Okay, so I think we've given enough guidance. Okay, so what we'll do is we're gonna go on to recommendation set two. We'll again hear a quick presentation by staff and then allow public comment on anything related to recommendation set two.
Okay, so recommendation set two is regarding the permit process. We had a couple approaches in the staff report. The recommendation for you to consider is applying a hybrid approach again, so that building permits or zoning clearance for repurposed ADUs or those within the existing primary dwelling unit are again building permits or zoning clearances. And one of the reasons that we have a kind of this hybrid approach or this lesser standard for the repurposed ADUs, some of it ties back to the fees that I had explained earlier. There's not as much planning that would go into repurposing some area within a building. It's mostly a building check. So that's where we're coming from on the repurposed. But for the detached or attached, any kind of new construction, we're suggesting that a land use permit without the right to appeal. I'm getting tired. That includes, so without the right to appeal, that we thought that was an appropriate permit path for these, you know, new construction that would allow some cost recovery on staff's time. It would be limited. We do have some information on our standard LUP fees. Mm-hmm. I think the application fee is $1,600 Did I get that right, Andy? Yeah, he's saying yes. So it's just enough to be able to go through the whatever kind of checklist or format that we have structured for the LUP and make sure that all of the details that are required in our ordinance are being met, in addition to the building checks. Let's see. So I think that about covers it. Did I catch everything?
Yeah, and just to, so with that LUP, just to be clear, typically an LUP has an appeal period, so that can prolong the process. And one of the things that was noted earlier in the presentation, so a pretty strict timeline for permitting these EDUs after an application is completed. So essentially, you know, for the added square footage, you would have an LUP just with the caveat that appeal period typical of an LUP would not be available in this case, to make it, you know, very clearly ministerial and be able to kind of police that timeline.
Can you talk a little bit more about what work is done with an LUP that's not done with a zoning ordinance? I think this is a little bit jargonous. There's a little bit of jargon here that I'm not sure if we all fully understand. So if you could help us, in addition to, there's a cost recovery element at the LUP, but presumably we're having that cost recovery because there's additional work happening. What additional work is happening at the LUP level that doesn't happen at the zoning clearance level?
Yeah, so I mean, when you have an ADU in an existing structure, presumably the zoning consistency, a lot of that work has been done, so the check on that could be quite quick. And if this ordinance had some design language, again, if you're not changing the exterior of the structure, that design process has been done in the past. So some of those, and again, the LUP for a new residence, which is to fall under 1600, it's not an extensive process, but it's doing a little more of that comprehensive look, make sure all the boxes are ticked in terms of, you know, percent of lot coverage, percentage of primary residence, setbacks, whether there's some design, some very basic design language, and then also issuing the LUP as an actual land use permit. So there's the issuance of the permit that needs to be done. So there's just, you know, fairly straightforward planning work, just kind of ticking those boxes, but a little bit more than just what you'd have with the zoning clearance would essentially be a little check-in at building, where a planner would kind of have an opportunity to quickly look over and ensure that standards are being met.
And so just as a clarification, so if we went with a zoning clearance option for the second rather than the LUP, what would that prohibit us from being able to do in terms of the extensiveness of the check?
And I think the standards would still get reviewed at the building permit, but there would be more staff time involved for new development, and we wouldn't have any cost recovery involved with that. So that would kind of be like an added burden in that respect for staff.
Not seeing a lot of, we have one more question.
So an LUP, does it have a hearing?
No, LUP does not have a hearing. It's a staff determination that typically gets noticed on site of an appeal period. But so there is no hearing.
It would only have a hearing if it was appealed.
That's right.
But this won't be appealed.
Right? A standard LUP, the hearing would be if there was an appeal.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so let's go ahead and take it to public comment. So this is a public comment period. Oh, one question first.
Sorry. I'm sorry, my light is acting up here. I apologize. Right now, if somebody was just doing a residential addition, it wasn't an ADU, but other types of additions to a primary residence, that goes through an LUP process, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, and that is a good point that you're making, that the LUP is not unfamiliar to folks.
Thank you.
All right, now we'll take it to public comment. So any comments related specifically to recommendation set 2, and if you want to go ahead and line up, and then just make sure to say your name when you come to the podium. If you haven't handed in a speaker slip, please make sure to do so.
Hi, Krista Pleiser with the Santa Barbara Association of Realtors. Just a lot of great comments have come from the commissioners on this issue. As you know, the city of Santa Barbara is dealing with this as well as the county, and taking an approach like this to this process has been great. Just one of the things is that on the process aspect itself, it should have a checklist with whatever ministerial process there is, because in that way, the city knows what it's looking for and the applicant knows what they're looking for. And that way it meets the 120 days and everyone is on the same page and it's just easier and it flows better. And that's one of the purposes of this law coming down from the state, is to make this process easier for people in order to create these units. And with these units, in order to, like what Commissioner Onan was talking about with the garage conversions, this is a great gift from the state for the city of Goleta in order to permit those garages to become safe, habitable, permitted units. And this also helps meet the new RENA numbers and actually meet it to where when you are meeting these RENA numbers, you can... actually, with the new state law that came down that says that you have to actually meet them for real and not just on paper. So this is going to be helping with that also. And we would be more than happy to help in any way that you all would need if you need additional resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Laura Ronquieto, and I'd like to thank you all for putting this together. There's so many things to consider. So I wrote down my statement to stay on track, because I recently went to actually request a permit for the ADU, and so I want to give you my experience as a Goleta resident. So the law, the state law, as you all know, is to restrict local control over ADUs for the purpose of allowing property owners more flexibility to build structures. So the intent of the new law is to significantly restrict and preempt local jurisdictions' authorities. So to keep this open, so let me tell you about my story. I bought my house in Goleta in 2009. My children were age 1 and 2 months. They are now 8 and 10 and attend Kellogg School. My husband and I divorced in May. We arranged that I would keep the house and he, in exchange, would pay no child or spousal support. I am left financially alone to raise my kids. My mortgage and property tax is $2,215. I now cannot afford that. I would like to build an ADU in our garage, which would help me pay the mortgage so that we can continue to have a home. This will help us and pay and help a renter to do with the housing crisis. I feel the planning fee not only goes against the intent of the state law, but it directly injures homeowners like myself and my kids, as well as future renters. I would like to let you know that it was $17,500 for the planning permit alone, not including any other costs. I called the city of Goleta this morning, and the city of Santa Barbara, they told me it was $103. Which was your question of why people haven't been doing this. People have been doing this illegally everywhere. They're illegal everywhere. This would just legalize the situation, not have to have me look over my back. Is my neighbor going to complain? Do things right so I don't lose money in the long term if I have to tear it down later. I don't have the money. And as far as the taxpayer goes, it would be a shame if Goleta has to defend the indefensible at a great cost to the taxpayers, because it is very clear what the intent was to make this easier for people in my situation. And to not, I mean, the space is there. If you're going to develop these horrible things that were developed over by Costco, they're just horrible. If we could just keep the space, I don't use the garage for anything. It's there. Why are we going to take the space? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Paul Poirier, architect. So the proposed ordinance allows flexibility for residents to address changes in their living situation while remaining in their homes. An ADU can accommodate an elderly parent or a family member beginning a new career or provide a home for another and rental income for the owners. Regardless of use, the ADU is a benefit for the owner and broader community alike, helping to maintain stability and continuity of residential makeup. The character of neighborhoods depends on residents and communal relationships. When a home changes hands, a new buyer may view a property as an investment potential rather than part of the neighborhood. We should not hesitate to enact policies that allow people to remain in their homes, especially as they affect those with lower incomes. The inclusion of ADUs will add to the diversity of the existing neighborhoods and housing stock, add living units within the existing character of the neighborhood more than a redeveloped McMansion, and enhance the neighborhoods and provide housing near places of work. ADUs should be encouraged. And I ran some numbers. I can't remember your name, but she said, Laura said her planning fees, and I think that includes the impact fees, school fees, police fees, park fees, all that stuff, 17 grand. Another gentleman who was in the front, I can't remember, he was trying to build an ADU, probably a new one from the ground up for his father, and he said that in January his fees would be $40,000. So if I took $40,000, like the average cost of construction is $200 a square foot, if I take the $40,000 and divide it by, say, a 600-square-foot ADU, that works out to $67 per square foot. So that's almost one-third of the construction cost is going to the planning department in impact fees. And if you, say, finance that $40,000 on a 30-year fixed, that amounts to $200 per month. So that's just on top of any construction cost alone. So to build like a 600-square-foot ADU and finance it at the going rate through a mortgage and add some of the fees on top and an architect's fee, you'll probably be at $876 per month as your base pay. So that will be cost, you know? And that didn't include the building permit fee either, which will probably be, you know, maybe another $50 on top of that. So right out of the gate, without any profit, it's not, quote unquote, being very affordable. So whatever the city can do to minimize the damage that and the cost of putting these things together, you can see clearly that the existing ordinance isn't promoting these things to get approved because it's very expensive and probably doesn't pencil out for most folks. But I think that they're a good thing for the neighborhoods, much better than people having to move out of their house and somebody viewing that house as maximum development potential to maximize the size of the home that they put on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm not seeing any other comments on recommendation set number 2. Okay, we'll go to Planning Commission comments. Who wants to start us off? Vice Chair Fuller?
I like the staff's proposal.
Additional comments?
So under the staff proposal for the LUP, the process would cost how much?
The way it's charged now, $1,600.
$1,600. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding some of the numbers.
There's kind of two different fees, and we didn't itemize impact fees for tonight. That's kind of one of those other questions that's out there that we'll be looking to address. There's a permit application fee which covers the cost of just processing the request by staff, and that's the $1,600. The impact fees go to address citywide impacts to like the need for parking in schools and transportation infrastructure, and those are charged really for all new development. It's kind of different for commercial versus residential, et cetera. But those are fees like our GTIP program is funded in large part through development impact fees. So those are kind of two separate fees that go into the total cost for the project.
And I'll add that not every city uses the impact fee approach to mitigate impacts. Like we use our Goleta traffic improvement program, and then we build a fee around that to look at how many trips are generated by the different uses, and then what are they contributing to our roads, and what does that equate in a, you know, trip per trip basis of an impact to the street. So that's the way the city has built its fee structure, and you know, different cities like Santa Barbara, they do it differently. So anyway, I wanted to clarify that, and I'm not defending it. I'm just saying this is the way that the city has built its fee structure, and it was like that with the county prior to incorporation as well. We are, the city is looking or updating the fee structure, and they're doing a study right now. So that will be, I'm not sure what the timeline is on that, but I think it's in this upcoming fiscal year, within this fiscal year, that we'll be bringing this before decision makers. So I think that will be a good time to get updated on all their various fees that we charge.
I assume the fees vary based on square footage?
So some of them are based on square footage. Transportation is based on peak hour. So like fire facility is square footage. But yeah, like a couple of the bigger ones are parks and transportation. Mm-hmm. Transportation is based on this peak hour trip. So what a project is contributing to kind of the peak hour, peak PM kind of traffic in the city.
I get, this is the first time since I've been on the commission that I guess I've had to, or that I've heard discussion of fees of that nature, and I wasn't aware. I would encourage staff in looking at how the permitting process is set up to consider the goal of ADUs. And that spending, if the speaker's numbers are correct, the $17,000 to, I don't know, would it be $17,000 to put up an 800 square foot unit? Sounds like something a little bit out of whack there. So without me being able to study it further and look at individual situations, that's just my comment.
And we'd like you to not tonight look at the fee system that the city has, because all of our infrastructure is built around this fee system. Other cities, again, City of Santa Barbara does it differently. But that's how, when you add new people to an area that wasn't already anticipated to have new people, that's the way we get money for parks and schools and services in general. Re-looking at that philosophically is something that goes kind of beyond where we're sitting right now. But the land use permit, if we just look at that on face value as far as the checklist process and a little bit of oversight, so if we can narrow what we're looking at, because we will come back and discuss the fee itself, because we do have the ability to do the tiered, well, we have to do mm-hmm. tiered fees. For ADUs, that's in our housing element, that's in state law. But if we just look at this strictly in terms of the kind of planning oversight, and we don't have to even come up with any kind of particular answer tonight, we can also show you what it might look like two different ways, because I don't think the ordinance is going to be, I think if we did it more ministerial with a zoning clearance, we would have to be really careful to articulate everything in the ordinance very mm-hmm. specifically that could translate into a checklist that could quickly be followed at the counter mm-hmm. so that we're not investing a lot of staff mm-hmm. time at the counter that's getting unrecouped. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of where we're coming from, is to get your sense of how much planning oversight we want. And then as far as whether or not it's, you know, mm-hmm. the fees are what they are right now. So if they come in the door, it's, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking $16,000-ish mm-hmm. To cover the cost of that impact based on the way the city's structure is set up for new development, essentially.
So just to clarify, I think one of the reasons we typically don't talk about the fee structures, I understand that's a city council decision. Planning commission usually doesn't determine fee structures. Is that correct?
Well, ultimately, of course, the council determines the fee structure, but that's something that you can consider and recommend in the context of this ordinance. I think okay. what Anne is saying is that we flagged that for a later workshop. We wanted okay. to kind of talk about the substance first and this fundamental permitting question, and we'll be back at a later date, a later workshop, and give you more information on development impact fees.
That's actually very helpful. Thank you for clarifying our role on that. So I'm happy to wait on that, but I, knowing where our jurisdiction is as a commission is helpful. So thank you both for that.
I do like staff's recommendation. I think it accommodates a couple of the things as far as if we are building within existing structures, that opportunity to take a illegal conversion and maybe even have it legalized, having that in a simple process of building permits is appropriate and I think would be effective. New, and I also agree with the idea that new construction would have an LUP process that allows us then to address the fee thing, because we also got to think about, you know, identifying something as one thing to avoid fees. It's an AUD instead of a room addition or something that could exist if we don't have anything associated with it. So I like the LUP portion for new structure or new square footage. I think the terminology is new square footage that we're using here. So I agree with that.
Commissioner Smith, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I would tend to defer to the staff recommendation. It's interesting. I'm thinking about the loss of not having the right to appeal in that context. I'm just, you know, thinking about a situation where there are just such significant fees and where an applicant loses the right to appeal. I don't feel great about that, but I know that under the law, like, we have certain parameters that the law is telling us that we need, you know, we need to keep it relatively simple and that we're working within that. Even with that concern, I would tend to defer to the recommendation. It may be one of those things where I don't know if in a, you know, a year or two, maybe it could be looked at as that being a significant barrier to the creation of units. But maybe we start with this and see how it goes.
Commissioner Smith, is your question about the right to appeal from the applicant or from somebody else?
Oh, that's an interesting. I was sort of thinking about the applicant, but
so if it's ministerial, then they come in, you go through your checklist, you hand them the permit,
right?
But the way our land use permit is now is that somebody could appeal it, someone else, like a neighbor, or someone else could appeal it to a higher body. So
the approval
body
would be appealed. Uh-huh. Okay.
So then this is saying the approval could not be appealed.
Right.
So
okay.
Then to go back to the applicant then, so if the applicant disagreed with the decision of the ministerial process, what would then happen?
Well, if it's ministerial, then it's over the counter in a way. So they you go through your checklist, you've met everything, you're good to go. So, the denial would be...
You can't appeal the denial.
Right, either. But if you didn't meet all of them, then what, you just argue with the guy across the counter?
So I think we're still trying to wrap our arms around this, but my understanding is that neither a denial nor an approval would be appealable. It would be an LUP without an appeal. Right. Of course, the city's action would still be reviewable by a court.
Oh, of course.
So that the intent would be to make the approval process a very streamlined one, a checklist where it was truly ministerial, and if an application met certain objective criteria, then the permit would be approved by right.
All right, I think I'll go ahead and jump in. I agree with the first part, building permit zoning clearances for repurposed ADUs without exterior additions. That makes sense for me. I struggle with the second part, honestly, because when I look at this, the purpose is a couple fold from the state. This is explicitly for affordable housing. There's a lot of guidance from the state to try to make this as accessible and as accessible and as affordable as possible. They've been very explicit that it should be ministerial and be as smooth of a process on the permitting size as possible. Where I see we're only talking about the application, the context of the LUP versus the zoning clearance,
I do think about the greater context of the fee structure. And if there's a place where I feel like if we're going to have to cut back somewhere, I feel like this is probably the place to do it because the state's asked us to streamline the permitting process as much as possible. I'd rather keep the funding for the schools and the GTIP and some of the other things where it's they're really paying for some of those broader impacts. And I suspect those fees will still be onerous enough without adding the LUP cost to it. I also know, I think it was sort of a comparison with the addition of a primary residence and that we do the LUPs for that. But I do see something different here, right? The with the primary residence, you're growing your own size of the house rather than sort of creating that opportunity for affordable housing more broadly within the community. So I do see that as being somewhat different. But the big thing I think for me is the state has really asked us to make this as streamlined as possible. We heard from the public comments about the opportunity that, you know, there should really be a clear checklist. I heard from staff that if we did go with a zoning clearance, we'd have to be extremely clear and streamlined with sort of both the checklist process and giving clear guidance to the staff at the desk. Those all seem like in line with what the state's asked us to do. So my leaning would be allow zoning clearance for both types listed here. And I realize I think that puts me in a minority, but I'll still put that out there. We'll do what we can. Any other comments from commission? Okay. We will go on to recommendation set 3. As before, we'll hear a quick presentation by staff on 3. Commissioners can ask clarifying questions, and we'll go back to public comment and go from there.
All right, so recommendation set 3 is regarding setbacks, and more specifically, the setbacks from the rear lot line. What we're suggesting here is taking a closer look at that rear set line in the R1. It's 25 feet, and I think I previously explained that you can go down to 15 feet. And we're suggesting that because of so many different site constraints on lots that we allow or consider allowing a reduction 10 feet or 15 feet, whatever it might be, while then you would also reduce the size of the ADU, so they're kind of scaled together. So if you go into your setback, then you would also reduce your size a little bit. So if that might accommodate a site plan, if there's something that's unforeseen that putting it in the setback makes some sense for that particular site. So that's where we're coming from on the setbacks and looking at some flexibility.
Clarifying questions from commission. Seeing one.
Just so you would repeat that in the event, so we would establish some minimum setback. For instance, this case, the 10. Would we allow encroachment into 10 with a reduction, or is 10 there would be no encroachment, 10 and under?
Yeah, the way we presented it here, 10 would be, that would be the minimum. So you would not be able to go within 10 feet of your lot line.
And would the possible reduction in the size of the ADU then function in between 25 and 10? I mean, I thought I heard you say something about reducing the size of the ADU as we go into the encroachment.
Yes, so that it does. Yes, so I just kind of got the concept out there for you to see if that you're interested in that, and if you are interested in something like that, we'll come back with more detail.
Okay.
But you know, it's just really the question about the setback. You know, are you gonna stick with the setback, and do you want it to be locked down, or is there some allowance for going into the setback?
And our side yard setbacks are really, I mean, they already go down to 5 feet, so that's as permissive as it can possibly be. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to balance out this rear yard 25-foot setback, really.
Yes, and then and that's in the R1, it's 25 feet, but in DR, it's not. DR is different, and it starts to get complicated there because it, and it almost becomes irrelevant.
Okay.
Because we're doing our new zoning ordinance and we'll be looking at setbacks with the new, in the new zoning ordinance. So I didn't want us to get too attached to the R1, but I was just pointing out that right now those standards would apply. So if someone came in for an ADU, the underlying district setback would apply. And in the R1, where many of our single family homes are, mm-hmm. is a 15 to 25 foot setback.
So let me follow up on that then too. Okay, so consider allowing ADUs within the R1 single family residential rear yard setback. So it's considering allowing ADUs within that 25 feet, but that 25 feet can already be reduced to 15 feet. Is that right? I seem to remember a 25 to 15 feet allowance.
It's an average, so okay. so you have to do some math in order to look at if you go below 25 feet, you have to do some math to make sure you're not encroaching a certain percentage into your rear yard setback, but no less than 15 feet.
Yeah, and that so that setback it starts at 25. You can have parts that are down to 15, but you still need to average your 25.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, you'll have other places. You couldn't have a structure completely at 15. If you went 15 in parts, you'd have to go beyond 25 in other areas. Okay. So this is the suggestion,
okay.
really, as a discussion point, is what if, potentially that setback could be a constraint mm-hmm. on building kind of additional square footage for your ADU. So considering maybe having a more relaxed standard than that. Mm-hmm.
So then to compare the second point to that, so would be average 10 feet and minimum what? Or is it average? How does that fit with the average and minimum?
The way it's written, it would just be a 10-foot standard. But, I mean, you could get kind of that, have that variable setback. This is certainly all within the discretion of the city. Okay. This was envisioned, for this discussion, just as a 10-foot, the side setback, it's 5 to 10 feet, but let's just say that's, if it's just a straight line at 5 feet, this would be just a straight line at 10 feet potentially. But we as a city can do what we please with that.
Okay, I think I understand that now. Any other clarifying questions before we go to public comment?
And so we also could change front yard setbacks, right?
All right, so we'll go ahead and take it to public comment. So any comments on recommendation set number 3? After this period, we will allow more general comments, but for now, please restrict your comments to recommendation set 3.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, hopefully that you'll be limiting the height of the detached ADU in the backyard to a one-story 15 or 16 feet. Most jurisdictions seem to use those numbers, that the detached ADU wouldn't be two stories into that setback. My only comment. You hadn't said anything about it. I don't know if that was going to be something that you had provided to the Planning Commission, that the height would be limited to a one-story. Okay, thank you.
Any additional comments on recommendation set 3? Okay, Planning Commission comments on recommendation set 3.
Yeah, I don't think we should change the setbacks at all. I think we should keep the neighborhoods as consistent for the benefit of all neighbors, and not start creating completely different neighborhoods with much greater density and lot coverage. If we keep the setbacks consistent, even with the ADUs, I think we'll have much happier neighbors.
I don't disagree with you, Commissioner Fuller, on that one. Flexibility in a plan has some value, but of course then you got to be faced with that. So if we're talking about a 5-foot variable, perhaps there is some way to address that. But if we're talking about bigger, that we want to retain a larger setback, then yeah, I would agree with you. We'd be best served within the community to try to honor those setbacks.
I agree.
I would be open to a setback adjustment. I'm wondering if to be more consistent with what we already have with R1, if we might consider 15 feet, because that is the lower range within the current R1. So that might be a place to start.
My leaning would be to maintain existing setbacks. However, with convincing, I could be open to the idea of considering allowing a rear yard setback reduction to 15 feet instead of 10 feet. If it does not exceed 800 square feet and it's one story, I would also add one story with that. And so then essentially you would have not required the average 25 feet, but you'd still have to hit the minimum 15 feet across at any point. I would be open to that, but my leaning is still to maintain existing setbacks.
I would also just add the recommendation, suggests, a limit of 800. And, I know we sort of had some discussion on size before that, depending on what range of sizes we decide, that decision could also impact this decision in terms of what we'd want as the maximum size in terms of allowing that. So I'll just note that as well.
Just one point of Commissioner Miller. When you said you agree, are you agreeing with Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry, did you also want to
speak? I had... So is there a height restriction contemplated? I don't know if the state requirement says anything about that.
We can regulate it.
The state doesn't is the, silent?
It's not, it's not prescriptive in what that height standard will be. Yeah. So we can certainly, as we look in potentially the rear setback or even detached units, we can certainly look at a height standard that varies from the district standard.
I think it probably makes sense.
I would agree that I think height along with size is I think a factor in all of this, really.
It's a big factor, yeah.
Well, we have height on one of our future workshops, and we have a long list of topics to come back to.
Absolutely. And okay. Some more information about design.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments on recommendation set number 3? Okay, so I think we've got everything there. Do you feel like you got enough feedback on 3? Okay.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay. So what I'd like to do, let's hear next steps first, and then what I'd like to do is open it up for the public comment to say anything that they didn't get to say yet but wanted to say tonight, and then we'll do the same thing with Planning Commission. Is that okay?
Perfect. So the next steps are based on the feedback that we got tonight, which was great, and appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And we'll get that to you summary in minute form at your next meeting. Mm-hmm. And we'll start sketching out the ordinance with this information so that you have a little bit more to look at. Mm-hmm. And then we'll also include additional items with recommendations for discussion that we had talked about throughout our conversation tonight and then earlier in the presentation. So, but I think this is critical information for us mm-hmm. to be able to get you something a little bit more detailed to review and comment on. And then we will do more public workshops again.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. All right. So what I'm going to do, I am actually going to read through the speaker slips this time just to make sure we caught everybody. And this is, you can comment on anything related to the ADUs that you didn't already say tonight. So I'll start with Cecilia Brown, and then we'll go to James Kiriakou.
Again, thank you. Ms. Wells indicated that design considerations would be coming back in this list, but one thing you've talked sort of about these numbers, setbacks, height, and site constraints, it would be really helpful if you could see some diagrams to understand the kind of what you're considering, rather than just throwing up numbers about what lots look like and how much you can get in a lot. And it might be helpful if staff prepare something for you on various lot sizes and how much you theoretically could get on a lot, just to see what it looks like. If you're not familiar with sort of that exercise, that I think it'd be very helpful to do that. Hopefully, you'll be discussing junior ADUs. I'm not sure. There wasn't anything about that tonight, but I don't know why you put that off till next time. But interesting concept. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much, James. And then we have Richard Callahan.
Hi, good evening again. It's James Carriaco. The one thing I would just say is that if you're going to revisit the notion of the heights of the buildings, I would strongly discourage you to do that unless you're going to revisit the notion of whether or not you should treat attached and detached structures the same. If you're going to start looking at height limits and wanting ADUs to go two stories or, heaven forbid, higher, please make sure they're attached to the existing structure only. If you start having two, three-story structures that are detached, that's going to very much change the character of Goleta. So please tread carefully there.
Thank you very much. Now, Richard Callahan? Not seeing. We have Patrick Carpenter. Paul Perrer.
Hi, so Paul Poirier. I think that if staff could get a fee and development fee chart for these ADUs of different sizes, it'd be helpful. Like if you got a 150 square foot, a 400, a 600, and a 1200, just to see what the impact fees would be, how they all stack up with other fees. I think that would put things in the context of affordability and that kind of thing. Deed restrictions, which you didn't talk about at all tonight. I've been involved in a lot of discussions with other jurisdictions with the AIA to talk about deed restrictions and how those can be enforced and what happens when inevitably the original owner passes away and the house gets passed on to somebody else and you have a deed restriction with the city. So clearly there needs to be a sunset clause for those so that it can just get sorted out at some point and not just lead to a train wreck on every single ADU. Submetering of water and power, you didn't discuss that at all, but we're very supportive of having that submetered by the tenant as opposed to required to be metered by the utility or the Goleta Water District, because the fees attached to putting in a new electrical service or a new water service are insanely high in terms of the cost for the construction of the unit and the affordability goal that we have for those things. Supporting junior ADUs, believe it or not, the AIA supports small unit sizes as well. You know, we are supporting flexibility for each individual situation. Also for the cooking facilities, flexibility in how those cooking facilities can be set up. Sometimes, like, I'm borderline whether I would trust my mother to have a full open flame. If I built an ADU in my backyard, I'd probably prefer to her to come into my kitchen where I can supervise her before she burns the thing down. You know, but people are in different situations. Maybe you have somebody who has Alzheimer's or something living with you, and, you know, you don't want them to have access to a full kitchen like that. Also, I think in the text I read, it said that you guys were considering having the main occupant of the house be the owner. But I think there's also a flexibility for downsizing your property. Maybe you have a really big house. You don't need that because all your kids have moved away. Your spouse has died, and you could survive in an 800-square-foot ADU. You could be the resident of the ADU and rent your house out. Again, trying to get to the goal of fewer square feet per person in the state of California. I think that the way we've set it up, where homes are our main economic vehicle, our main lifetime bank account that we've soaked all our money to and paid for all this time, eventually it's going to be down to the one remaining person in the family living in an oversized house, unless we give them some medium to swap out of that without leaving the neighborhood, without leaving the place that they're familiar with. So I think that that's a viable option for a lot of baby boomers who are going to be getting there pretty soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I believe Laura Ranchietto has left. Krista Pleaser.
Hi, Krista Pleaser. Just wanted to reiterate that this process should be as simple as possible for the residents who are going to be using it, not just in the process itself, but everything that's attached to it, all of the rules, all of the regulations. It should be as simple as as possible. And the reason why I'm saying this is having spoken to quite a few people up in Sacramento on this issue, dealing with the city of Santa Barbara and the county and things of that nature. The maker of this bill originally is now coming and looking at the area of Santa Barbara as the 805 defiance. So it'd be great if we'd be able to go and say, hey, Goleta is a shining example of not being part of this. And so I just highly recommend on keeping it simple, keeping it streamlined, and just not adding too many barriers for people to adhere to this. Thank you.
All right. Are there any additional public comments? This will be the last opportunity for a public comment tonight. Okay. Not seeing any additional ones, and having gone through all my speaker slips, I will go ahead and bring it back to the Planning Commission to do our wrap up. And so for this, maybe we could just do each Planning Commissioner just kind of gets a few minutes on their own. So maybe I think we've been starting on this side. So this way, Commissioner Smith, would you like to make any wrap up comments?
Sure. I wanted to thank everybody who attended tonight's hearing for all of your thoughtful comments. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I see the one woman has left, but you know, sharing those personal stories, you know, that's the, you know, those are real stories that are happening in our community. I think this is an exciting opportunity for us to create really some affordable by design structures in our community, whether it's garage conversions or sort of additional units. And I think overall the staff has given some, you know, is on the right track in terms of what's already been presented. I do wonder if some of the setback requirements and or the permitting processes might continue to be a barrier. But for now, I'm sort of, you know, willing to sort of stick with what sort of has been our consistent process and maybe look at, you know, a year from now, as we check back in, maybe we can, you know, see where we are on, you know, have ADUs been developed or not. And maybe there could be a potential to check back in on where we are. But overall, I think this is an exciting opportunity for our community.
Okay. Vice Chair Fuller.
Yeah, I just also wanted to thank everybody for their input and their participation, and I hope they continue to participate and continue to provide input. It's valuable. Thank you.
Commissioner Onan?
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Commissioner Miller?
I don't think I have anything to add either. Well, I'll just say this. I housing is a huge issue in California. We read about it all the time. It is a huge challenge for us as a state and a community. And I hadn't really given a whole lot of thought to ADUs until this issue came before us. And I think we do have an opportunity to do something smart that doesn't change the character of our community yet. Allows for additional housing options for workforce and persons and families of lower income in Goleta.
I'll wrap up and say a thank you to all the folks who came out and gave public comment tonight. A thank you for staff for putting a wonderful presentation together and really making it very clear for us as we got through the process. So I appreciate both of those. I appreciate all of you very much for that. There's many things that I think to say, but I know we have future workshops, and many of the topics that we weren't able to cover tonight will be addressed at future workshops, and I look forward to that. You know, one thing I would say is I want to think about how we can make this appealing enough that those existing ADUs that aren't permitted, that are kind of under the radar, particularly those garage units, come forward. I know a number of friends and folks, that acquaintances from the area, that have been in situations that they've been renting out a garage and not on a lease because it wasn't an appropriate, it wasn't a legal operation, and so they ended up sometimes at quite a disadvantage when they had landlord-tenant disputes. And so really thinking about how do we make this appealing enough, not just to encourage new units, but that the fees are low enough, the process is smooth enough that folks, existing programs, existing structures, owners are coming forward with those. So that's a general thought that I have, but otherwise I'm really excited about where we are in the process. So thank you. So with this, let's move on to director's report.
Thank you very much. Very briefly, a couple of items. First, in before you are commemorative mugs from our celebration of volunteers a couple weeks ago, in case you didn't get one or weren't able to attend. We had a few left over. Also, a reminder, this Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. in these council chambers, there will be the third workshop on the historic preservation context statement. We encourage everyone to attend. We have one more PC meeting this year in December, and that's it.
All right. Do we know what is likely to be on that last December meeting yet?
Yes. At this point, what we hope to bring to you is a summary of the state housing law changes, which the commission had requested. We are working on that, and of course, we're juggling a lot, but our hope is that we'll have that ready for you.
Thank you very much. I'll take it to Planning Commission comments. Any Planning Commission comments? All right. No comments from the Planning Commission. I will now take motions to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
I'll say aye if you support.
Aye.